I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Conversations this week on What's Next will be focusing on reflections on change. As we mark the 2-year anniversary of the racist attack on the Jefferson Avenue Tops that claimed the lives of 10 people and left 3 others wounded. Today's conversations focus on challenges. And first, we hear from Dr. Henry Louis Taylor, Jr., the founding director of the UB Center for Urban Studies. On this episode of What's Next, we have a returning guest, Dr. Henry Louis Taylor, Jr., from the University of Buffalo, including the director of their Center for Urban Studies. Dr. Taylor, welcome back.
It's a pleasure to be back. I always love chatting with you.
Absolutely. And we have a lot to get into. We really wanted to, there's so much to go, and you have your most recent report, How We Changed the Black East Side, which we want to get into. And I think in a lot of ways we'll be weaving in and out of that report in this conversation. But we want to start off by talking about the challenges. We're reflecting back over the last 2 years since May 14th, 2022. And I'm going to just make an assumption that a lot of the challenges haven't grown or haven't been diminished on Buffalo's East Side. But I want to get into some of the different elements of this. And it's interesting because we did talk before we went on the air and how getting ready for what's going to come out of this report, How We Changed the Black East Side, is a neighborhood demonstration project. And you're doing a lot of interviewing of households in certain census tracts inside the city. And you're finding some responses inside these surveys that you say are surprising, that are even maybe, you know, changing your view of what's real on the East Side. Let's talk about some of those.
Yeah. I mean, when you work with demographic data and you spend a lot of time simply down on the ground talking with people about the challenges that they face and the things that you understand theoretically from all of the reading and studies that you do. But you lose sight of a lot of that stuff on a day-to-day basis. And so when I'm studying the results of the census data, the survey data, they started to reveal a very powerful story that in this context was somewhat surprising to me. It wasn't. What started to emerge comes from 3 types of questions that we posed, wanting to get insight into how people felt about their neighborhoods and communities. First, we wanted to know, why did you move to this community, this neighborhood? Secondly, we wanted to know, what 3 things do you like about this place? And finally, we asked them if there was one thing you would never want to be changed about this neighborhood, what would it be? And then we asked about the things they disliked and the things they would want to change most. And what emerged is a theme we're loosely calling the beautiful and the terrible.
Hmm.
We found that people love their neighborhood.
Which in some ways, it goes against a common perception.
Yeah, you get this idea from the press and others that people just want to get out, that this is a bad place, that they want to leave. But down on the ground, you feel the love, that people are attracted to the place. They love the people. And this theme bounces over and over. I love my neighbors. the caring. They love elements of the physical environment. Many people talked about the place where they lived and the attachments that they have to that. Oftentimes in these neighborhoods, they're close to not just friends, but relatives.
Mm.
You know, and so you have this powerful strength. People often will talk about convenience, being able to get to where they want to go to. And as you listen to the comments, it's the power of what they say in these simple words. And then when you generate a word cloud and you can look at the portrait of pictures and you can see and sense the magnitude of that attachment. And later, after they've been there a while and you ask them to list those three things, one of the more remarkable aspects is that you see this correlation with the things that they say they care the most about their community and the things that attracted them there first. So their expectations were met.
Mm, okay.
And we call that the beautiful.
Sure.
Then when you ask what they dislike, they're clear in relationship to that. And the things that stand out the most are on that side are crime and drugs, but also the conditions of the physical environment. The neglect of that physical environment.
Sidewalks.
The sidewalks, the streets, the abandoned properties, the properties that are poorly maintained, the unkept vacant lots, liquor bottles and glass on the streets, the dirtiness of the streets, the failure of the city to maintain the quality of that physical environment. And out of that, there is this sense of aloneness. And by aloneness, it's like, wow, we're on our own. We got no help. We are on our own. And I think in a couple of remarks, statements from the surveys that we've analyzed so far really stood out. And in a discussion about crime and drugs and the looming presence of violence is the statement, and the police are always on the other side of the street.
Hmm.
As if they are here, but doing nothing. Another talking about the city does not care about this neighborhood. And another about our council has to do better. There were not a lot of these comments, but when you contextualize them within the larger commentary, they stood out and gave us insights. And along those lines, we're beginning to see that many of these neighborhoods and communities are not organized. This isn't to say that they're not organizations in
right,
them.
Right, right.
And they're not people working on this and that and the others. But they're not organized as a neighborhood. And as a consequence, that there's no shared vision of what they want in that neighborhood community. No capacity to act as a singular entity and a unit which keeps them from being able to fight for the policies and the resources that they need to be able to bring about change. And so one of the things that we're concluding, all of this, of course, is tentative,
sure,
is that there's an organizational mismatch. The problems and difficulties that we face are over here, but the organizations that we have created and built are over here. Therefore, we can't do what we need to do in order to bring about change and to protect ourselves and our community from the encroachment of outsiders. And you hear this all of the time. I was at a place the other day having dinner and a drink, and some folks from Mercer Street were there and talked to me about the challenges that they were facing on their street, where a social service agent and others were building an establishment that they felt was detrimental to the community. The larger point was they had no voice in the development of their community. They were powerless, and that outsiders were making choices and decisions about how to develop the land, how to manage the property, what they would put there, what they would take away. They had no control, no self-determination, and they were angry about it. And again, the question was not so much, well, this social service agent, was what they were doing was good or what they were doing was bad. The bigger question is that the people who live in the neighborhood had no real say. People listened, but not really. And you start with, this is a kind of a theme that we're starting to feel when we have this different layer of conversations and we're just listening to and trying to understand what the people are saying in their interviews. And we've done about 500 of them.
You also mentioned, and this is, I thought, an interesting anecdote, and I know you probably don't have all the information or the data, but the city's 311 line where residents can call in with problems. And this goes back to your comment about how there's a sense of being alone.
Right.
As many issues as there are on these east side neighborhoods, there are very few compared to other parts of the city calls to this 311 line.
Yeah, we did an analysis of these 311 calls about a year ago. And one of the most interesting things that we were finding is they were concentrated mostly where you get the most noise in these communities where we believe gentrification was occurring and where new groups were coming in and demanding the city bring about different types of shifts and changing and demanding that cultural activities down on the street that they did not like be altered. And we were struck that around housing-related types of calls, where we knew a lot should be coming from the east side, just wasn't a lot. And so the conclusion is that, again, when people feel as if what they say does not matter or could hurt them, and a lot of folks feel they're caught in a trap. Look, if I say something about my landlord and the quality of the house, the city won't do anything. They won't make them change. Then if they come out and inspect, and they find that the place is really in a bad situation, they condemn it, and I gotta move.
Right.
And so there is, at this level, we believe, a kind of sense in many places where I'm damned if I do and I'm damned if I don't. And this is reflected, and you just don't see, you know, these many layers of calls. So we're still early on in our research and our work, but are the insights that we're starting to get from this in-depth look at what the people are saying, it's given us greater levels of understanding. There's also a thing that we call oppositional space, and that we're seeing increasing the amounts. And the oppositional space are spaces in these neighborhoods and communities where people are trying to reclaim in a positive way.
Okay.
You'll see community gardens. You'll see murals. There is some graffiti that falls into these categories. Even some of the monuments that the young people will put on poles to honor and memorialize loved ones. They all are stamps of people attempting to say to the developers, to the landlords, to the speculators, this is not our space, the decaying and dilapidated things. This is our space, the opposition. And so we think in these communities that three dimensions of reality the beautiful, the terrible, these the hardships, the crime, the violence, the decaying, the dilapidation, and then what we call resistance, creativity, and building that space where you then see efforts on the part of the people who live there to destroy the terrible and convert and transform it into the beautiful. And so we see across this space the interactions of these three dimensions. And this is what gives us great hope about the future of our city and about the future of the East Side. And I walk away humble by the beauty of my Buffalo.
As we talk about this, and I'd love to hear the fact that you're hopeful, because you have been spending years, a good portion of your career, researching the realities of Buffalo's East Side. I think I already know the answer, but it's clear, or I would think you're going to say this, it is clear that if the way things are being done now, in terms of low-hanging fruit projects, you know, trying this project, this effort here, there, and everywhere, if that continues, we're going to be back here 5 years from now and saying the same thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's like running on a treadmill. You're running very, very hard, extending all kinds of energy, pushing yourself to the limits, but you're going nowhere. You're running in place. And I think we see a lot of that. And it's led me to a conclusion after talking with a lot of people in powers and positions of authority, that in this city and on Buffalo's East Side, our greatest challenge is an unwillingness to see our greatest challenge. We engage, we wallow in fantasy, and we would rather hear the reassuring lie than the painful truth. And as a consequence, we will not face our greatest challenges and try to solve them. Instead, we go looking for some low-hanging fruit. We don't want to get that stuff at the top. And you see it over and over and over again. Let me give you a very specific example.
Please.
Substandard rental housing is our top problem. Operating at multiple levels. At the top of the list, it's killing people. Children's lives are being destroyed by lead in the house. All kinds of chronic illnesses are generated by the poor quality and conditions in these houses, and the fact that we do not have a minimum standard beneath which no house in Erie County is allowed to fall. Shameful. Right now, anybody listening will get into more trouble driving a car with an inspired inspection ticket than they will from renting a house full of lead that's destroying the lives of our young people. Structural violence. Yet, we can get the city announcing the building of hundreds of infill housing on vacant lots, but won't even enforce the existing building codes. With our children's lives being destroyed by lead, engaged in a debate back and forth with the county over whose problem is it, who is supposed to solve this problem. Fighting against people who are simply saying, will you enforce the law? Will you do what you said you will do? And they won't. And so on street after street after street, the substandard housing continues to destroy lives. The irony of all of this, and we've run some of these numbers, that a significant 60-70% of these rental housing units are owned by people who don't even live in the city, in Erie County and beyond. I think that number's about, in one tract that we've looked at, it's about 48-49%, somewhere like that. Which means that each month, millions of dollars are flowing out of the city of Buffalo without circulating and producing a single job or opportunity. Money thrown out. And we just sit back and do nothing, you know, about it. And this is what I'm talking about when I say we can't face the challenges that we have and say, well, how can we fix this? And making fixing this, no matter how complicated and difficult it is, our number one priorities. Now, you will hear some people say, well, Doc, that's impossible. And I agree, it is impossible. But my grandfather once told me that impossibility only defines the degree of difficulty involved in achieving a task. Leaders are supposed to do the impossible. Leaders are supposed to reach the unreachable star. Leaders are supposed to defeat the unbeatable foe. That's what a leader is supposed to do. And right now, substandard housing is undefeated.
And it doesn't look like there's much of a game going on right now, or contest. Henry,
it's a massacre. It's what they say in sports. It's a rout.
It's a rout.
The city got knocked out in the first 3 seconds of the first round by substandard housing, and did not ask for a rematch.
We are talking with Dr. Henry Louis Taylor Jr., Center for Urban Studies at the University of Buffalo. You brought this up in your last answer, and But I think it's a great way of looking at a challenge that's inside a lot of these neighborhoods, a lot of the East Side neighborhoods. And what right now seems to be the approach to dealing with it, you were talking about vacant properties and infill housing. And right off the, we've talked a little bit about this before we went on the air, but right there, the approach that as you see emerging is also not going to answer any kind of comprehensive issues in Buffalo's East Side.
Yeah, a number of people are looking at infill housing and as magic. Not everybody. And when I say not everybody, I'm putting Senator Ryan in that category of people who have a deeper understanding of the infill housing piece. And there are others. But there's a significant grouping that sees this infill housing as magical. You build the infill housing, and then you can walk away, and magically that will transform or change neighborhoods, and it won't. There are others who mistakenly believe that if you build the infill housing, you can increase home ownership in these neighborhoods and communities, and that means that suddenly people are producing generational wealth, and now you bought a home and you became a member of the middle class. again, that's more fantasy than reality. Let me be very specific. In the hardest hit neighborhoods on Buffalo's East Side, the ones that we're looking at, they most of them also have high concentrations of vacant land. But one of the most striking features is that they have high rates of home ownership.
Really?
Well above the citywide. I'm talking about, in some instances, many as 50% of the people own their own homes. And in one community in the Broadway Fillmore area, you have around 69% of the African-Americans who live there owning their home. And across the board, about 60% of the people are homeowners. But that's not engines of wealth production. In the Broadway Fillmore area, the value of an owner-occupied house in that community is only around $38,000. And to put that in perspective, if I put 10% down on a $400,000 house, I could have bought that unit and paid cash for it and half the other houses inside of that neighborhood and community. And in a number of other locations, including the community where Tops is located, the median house value is only about $46,000 or $47,000. That's not wealth production. And so then when you add to that the high levels of foreclosure in the African-American community, the large number of mortgages that are underwater. And for your listeners, an underwater mortgage is a mortgage where you owe more than the house is worth. And then you factor in the subprime rates that people have. Home ownership is very, very, very problematic. One of the ways you can stabilize that is by strengthening the entire community. So rather than just have infill housing and walk away, you've got to develop comprehensive planning so that you're developing the entire community. And why is that so important? In most of these neighborhoods, there is an intermixture of the owner-occupied house, the substandard, decaying, and dilapidated rental house, the abandoned housing units, the unkept vacant lots. And if you overlay the deteriorating sidewalks, the poor streets, and the lack of maintenance on a lot of properties in those areas, you can see how the value is depressed. Also, it's important to understand that the challenges that Black folks face and other people, they're not single sector. They're interrelated and interconnected. So housing is connected to the poor education, to the joblessness, to the mental issues that people face, to the substance abuse, to the partner brutality, and to the lack of hope that generates people entry into informal economies and becoming criminals. All of those things are interrelated and interconnected. So you have to develop a comprehensive strategy that attacks them all simultaneously. That is how you transform the neighborhood and the community. So if you put infill housing within the context of a comprehensive plan, it can be powerful because it allows you to immediately begin to remake the neighborhood. The mass demolitions unmade the neighborhood. Infill housing allows you to remake the neighborhood. And as you're remaking the neighborhood, it can catalyze, under a planning framework, working closely with residents, other forms and types of development that occurs within that context. And those are the things that Senator Ryan has been talking about in attempts to get folks to understand it's not just the infill housing and you walk away. It's infill housing as the first step toward neighborhood transformation. But there's a lot more work that needs to be done. And that's what we've got to get when we start talking about infill housing. Otherwise, it again will end up being the sound of one hand clapping, making no noise, but exerting a lot of energy.
As you, and again, I know that so much of this is in preliminary stages, but part of the how we change the Black East Side, you're looking at coming up with a neighborhood where all of these elements could be, this planning concept. How big of an area are we talking about approximately?
We're talking about an area that would be geographically the size of a census tract.
Okay.
Conceivably, it could even be a little bit larger. We're talking about probably no more than 3,000 to 4,000 residents. So Buffalo's neighborhoods are low-density communities. And the largest population groups of the five census tracts that we've selected is about close to 4,000.
All right.
And some of the others are smaller than that. So it'll be a large geographical area, but the number of people in that will be relatively small.
And right now it's narrowed down to, what, a handful of census tracts?
Yeah, we've narrowed it down to five census tracts. For those of you who have census tracts maps in your head, census tract 42, which is in the Ken Bailey neighborhood and community, census tract 34, which is where the Northland Training Center is situated, census tract 33.02, which is where Tops Supermarket and the heart of Jefferson Avenue is located, and that will be the site where the cap or bridge covering the Kensington Highway Expressway will be located. Then there's census tract 166, which is in the Broadway Fillmore area just south of Martin Luther King Park, and that's adjacent to the last one, is 3501, which is in the Martin Luther King neighborhood and community. And conceivably, you could merge 3501 and 166, which would allow you to pick up the Martin Luther King Park as a part of an asset to that community, along with the Fillmore Avenue Commercial District.
So
so within that larger area, we'll create sub-planning units, and the planning will operate under three schemes: people, housing, and neighborhood. And all of the root issues that we've been talking about can be distributed across those three dimensions.
And I know I'm probably reaching a little too far in advance, but as you're looking and determining which of these you're going to pursue, is it going to be, there's a lot of factors in there, but is one of those key factors the certain ability or an understanding that you have the both human potential inside there, and I'm talking about, you were talking about organization before and such, and making sure that those types of individuals are there, or is it more of a physical thing that, yeah, there's lots of potential here if we can?
It's going to be a combination of those things. One, and most important, is that we want to be in a place where there's this population that is both strongly attached to place, highly optimistic, but we get a sense that these people are prepared to fight for the policies and the resources for their neighborhoods and communities. Because we have no illusions that transforming and changing neighborhoods is a battle. And you're going to have people be able to mobilize the population. But in addition to that, and that people core, we want to look at the dynamics of land use development that's already existing there. And so you're looking at the extent to which other external forms of development are occurring that might create turbulence that's good or bad. You're looking at the relationship of the residential development to other commercial and industrial forms of development. We're looking at ownership. So an area where there's a lot of public land ownership is a lot more appealing than an area where most of the land is owned by private interest. Because the assumption is that the city will work closely with us and the land bank will work closely with us. So communities with large swaths of vacant land would probably look good, as opposed to a place that's built up with literally no vacant land. So the existing state of land use development will be very important, as well as the population mix. We're also going to be looking at where that community stands in relationship to the gentrification threat.
Mm.
Is it in an area where we know gentrification is moving and gaining momentum? If it is, we might want to go there as a way of putting that to a stop. Then a more complex is that we're looking for the potential of unity. And by that, our first mission is going to be the creation in collaboration with the people who live in the neighborhood and the community of a shared vision. And it's going to take time for that. We expect anywhere from 6 to 8 to 10 months developing that shared vision, because you want people to agree on the type of community that you want to build. That becomes the anchor. Then all of your other elements, your values and other pieces, become this GPS system that will guide you from where you are to the destination, that futuristic city.
Dr. Henry Louis Taylor, Jr., founding director of the Center for Urban Studies at the University of Buffalo. There's more to our conversation that'll be heard in an upcoming episode of What's Next. Now, continuing on the theme of challenges, here's Thomas O'Neill White talking with Kendra Brim.
Join WBFO every Saturday at 6 p.m. for an insightful and enlightening series of audio documentaries from our region that tackle topics such as the environment, health, the world of entertainment, and more. Listen to the WBFO DocuHour every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on WBFO, your NPR station.
Public media is more than Morning Edition and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Buffalo Toronto Public Media creates digital series to ignite curiosity in young learners, free lesson plans, videos, and training for teachers and parents, and events to empower the minds of our community's next generation. This is Public Media.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
This is What's Next, and in the aftermath of the 2-year anniversary of the racist shooting that claimed the lives of 10 people and wounded 3 more, we are diving deep into issues illuminated by the shooting. Joining us today is Kendra Brim, the Executive Vice President at the National Urban League Young Professionals and host of the Black Gems Dive In podcast. Kendra, thank you for being back on with us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Much like critical race theory and woke, diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, is now being seen as a pejorative to some sections of our society. How did we get to this point with these three terms, that where these three terms are looked at negatively, and why does it keep happening?
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, first of all, it's really great to be back. And I just want to first, before we even dive in, like we say on our podcast, I just really want to just give honor, but then also to a moment to just really think about and pause on really what happened in our community in 514 a few years ago. It was a tragic event that happened. Unfortunately, these events keep happening. And so we have to, unfortunately, keep having these conversations. But hopefully these conversations will continue to highlight some of the injustices that still exist within our society. So I just wanted to put that out there before we kind of dive into that. And so how do we get here, right? I think about this all the time, right? DEI, woke, all these different things in terminology, critical race theory, and how it's being spun to be something negative.
Mm-hmm.
I think about even prior to this, before even these words came about, I think about my ancestors, my grandparents, and some of the things that they fought against in the civil rights movement. This is something that's not new, right?
Right.
And so as much as we keep saying, oh, when is it going to get better? When is it going to get better? We see highlights of things getting better, but we also see where we're maybe taking one step forward, two steps back, right? And so this is something that's not new. We could continue to change the words. We can continue to change what the landscape may look like, but the work still has to continue. And so even if you want to get rid of the words diversity, equity, inclusion, the work still has to be done. And so when you talk about like, how do we get here? We'll continue to probably arrive at these moments in time, these critical points and junctures in our society, but we have to just keep remembering what the prize is at hand, and we have to just keep pushing forward.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see where we've taken steps forward?
Yeah, so I think about in many aspects, especially within my work with the National Urban League Young Professionals, you're seeing more representation in the legal system. You're seeing more representation when it comes to elected officials, things that didn't necessarily happen previously. You're seeing more representation in media where stories are being highlighted that traditionally have not been highlighted. So you're seeing those pieces, right? But where you're seeing the points and inflections where we're taking a step back is in legislation. We're right. seeing that in the South, right? And when we're looking at diversity, equity, inclusion, and some of those things that we're taking a step back, it's not just when we're talking about from a race perspective. We're talking from a gender perspective, LGBTQ rights. You're seeing where abortion laws are being tested, right? So it's the entire spectrum. And at this point, everyone is being affected. So that's where we're kind of seeing those steps back. But I will say the four steps that we're seeing are media, legislation. There's so many wins, but and we can't lose sight of that.
Well, to push back a little bit on yes. that, there are some people who would say, you know, with regards to the legal system, it's mm-hmm. merely putting black faces on white structures.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And so when you're looking at this, we have to continue to dismantle, right? So when you're saying putting black faces on white structures, we need the black faces. We need the women. We need LGBTQ representation
100%.
On top of those systems in order to continue to knock down those systems. Because otherwise, you're going to have the same people building up these walls, mm-hmm. Perpetuating some of the injustices that are happening. So you need people in the legal system to continue to knock it down. And I will say it is a fight, right? You're swinging left and right every day. You're feeling like you're being knocked down. You're feeling like you're not being heard, but you have to keep sight of just those small wins. And I know there are people out there to say, well, you know, the justice system hasn't done anything for me. The justice system has failed me or my family or whatever the case may be. We know that rhetoric is out there and we know that to be true in some instances. But again, we have to continue to infiltrate these systems to knock it down. When we think about specifically black people in America, we are 400 years behind, right? Mm-hmm. And that is a fact. And so for us to continue to knock down those places, we have to be in places that we traditionally were not allowed to be or to continue to infiltrate where we can.
You work as a DEI consultant.
Yes.
What challenges do you see there?
Mm-hmm. There are many challenges as a consultant. The first is to your point about words. Words matter. I'm going back to our original question about critical race theory and woke and what do those things mean and highlight diversity, equity, and inclusion. There's so much to be said. There are people who say like, yes, we should have it, right? It is in testing that, it's not a feel good, nice to have, let's just put it on our collateral, let's get some faces, take pictures, mm-hmm. highlight what we're doing, highlight specific months. It has to be embedded into what you're doing. It has to be embedded into your DNA. And so as a consultant, those are some of the struggles that I see because you have, again, going back to systems, you have these systems that are in place. And so you literally have to break down each system and say, okay, is equity embedded in this? Is inclusion embedded in this? And I will say in this work, right, the diversity piece is quote unquote the easier part, right? I can get some people, some diverse faces into an organization. But the equity piece, the middle piece, is the hard piece. And that's when we're talking about wording. You're seeing a lot of companies taking out the equity, the E piece. Oh, we're still doing it, but are you, right? Mm-hmm. Why are you taking it out? Because some people may question that. And so the hard part really is getting down to the nitty gritty, really asking the questions. And then also too, asking questions back to organizations to say, are you willing to lose people? Are you willing to lose funding? Because that's what's happening. Once, you know, people start having those questions, that's where the tough conversations start to happen. So that's where some of the difficulties lie. And I will say also too, in this work, as we're progressing, there's a group of people, there's people in general who feel like they're being left out of the conversation on both ends, right? Mm-hmm. There are people who say, okay, this company is saying that they want diversity, equity, inclusion, but I don't see it in the systems that exist. I don't see it in the culture right? And that is huge. We talk about culture all the time. I don't see it in the culture. So I feel like I'm being left behind. And then you have another group of people on the opposite end of the spectrum who may say, well, this organization, my organization is doing all that quote unquote DEI work, right? Or they're woke, right? Where do I fit into the equation? So what you're starting to see in this world and what you see even on a national scale is everyone's retreating back to their corners,
yes,
right? Because people feel like they're being left behind. So how can we continue to come together and have this conversation to say everyone benefits from this? Something that I talk about on our, we just talked about on our podcast is targeted universalism. And that whole idea is how can everyone get a shared piece of the pie, shared piece of the puzzle, so everyone is benefiting. So we're not just talking about from a racial perspective. Like I said, we're talking about LGBTQ rights. We're talking about women's rights. All these things are being tested on a national level and within the organizations themselves. And I see organizations, some organizations really want to do the work, but they get tested day in, day out by the systems, the culture, and the people that put those systems and culture in place.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like, when you're working with organizations, can you gauge how intentional they are with that work, like right off the bat, or do you just... You need to know more and more and more.
You always need to know more and more and more, right? So when I go into organizations, the first thing I do is like either it's two things. I evaluate the landscape. So I do like a landscape discovery phase where I'm interviewing staff. I may be interviewing C-suite executives. And then I also too will put together a full environmental scan. So I am evaluating your culture, number one, but then also too, I'm evaluating some of your policies and practices you have in place. I'm evaluating your communications, internal and external. I'm evaluating even what your board makeup looks like, literally doing a full gut check of the organization, which takes time, and then providing a recommendation back to the organization. You can kind of see how vested an organization is or isn't based off of how much money they're able to invest into having this full diagnostic, I like to say, or this test for the organization. And also too, when I work with organizations, I tend to also go to some of their outside events just to see who's there, what are the conversations, how are you engaging with the community at this point, because it is about the community, especially in Western New York. So I do that full scan and literally have them do their own gut check, because I could tell them like, hey, you should be doing this. But then also too, they have to be fully vested. Sometimes those plans, right, or the strategic planning behind it goes by the wayside because they don't have the resources or time. And that's when you can see, are they fully vested, right? And then some of them say, no, this is what we really want to do. And either they keep me on as a consultant or a retainer, or they hire full time, which is also the recommendation. I will say too that with organizations, sometimes they will hire a full time diversity, equity, and inclusion representative or someone in that seat. But again, it has to be embedded in the culture. You can't have this one person doing the full work of DEI organizations, as we talk about. It has to be embedded. It has to be from a cultural standpoint. You have to back it by resources. You have to back it by time. And it can't just be a one-off. Yeah. So there's a lot of work as a consultant that we do.
Do you find a lot of these organizations lack the resources?
Yes. Yes. A lot of organizations. And let me take a step back. It's not that they always just lack the resources, because if there was an initiative or something that they really wanted to do, they'll find the resources. Right. So it's not necessarily just always lacking the resources. Now, you have like smaller non-for-profits in the area and outside the area that may not necessarily have the actual money to invest, but you can tell that they are invested from the cultural standpoint. There are some organizations that may not necessarily be fully invested in it. But again, people always say they find the time and resources that they want to find the time and resources for. Right. And so we have to sometimes be creative in how we pull from that. But when we're looking at evaluating and measuring kind of where we are from where we started, this is why I always keep saying, like, you can't measure what you can't see. Or backwards, you can't see what you can't measure. You have to measure, and it has to be from a qualitative and quantitative perspective.
And that leads me to my next question, measuring success with these DEI initiatives.
Yes, yeah. So it has to be a qualitative and quantitative. So you pull from multiple resources. So an engagement survey, that's a very high level. You can see the attitudes of your staff. You can get a lot of information from that perspective. But they have to be really targeted questions. Engagement surveys sometimes, again, are like feel-good surveys, right? But you have to have those targeted questions geared towards culture, geared towards just the overall attitudes of that organization. And then also, too, what you have to measure is you have to measure representation from your board perspective. What does your board look like? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times when I say that, a lot of people may say, well, you know, this is the landscape of my board, or we're going to go out and get more board members, but it may be we're going to go and target Black people. We're going to go target LGBTQ community women. But what exactly skill set are you looking for, right? So it can't just say, Thomas, we're going to bring you on as a board member, right? It's like, but what skill set do you also bring onto the table? So
otherwise, that's kind of like tokenism.
It's tokenism, right? And so we saw that very performative work. And so now I always tell organizations to really look at a board matrix. So really write down some of the gaps that you have. And then also, too, pulling from your networks to see who can fill those gaps. But sometimes that may be tested, right? Because your network, we always talk about you stay close to people who you know, mm-hmm. who look like you, who think like you. And so it's now challenging sometimes the board members to go into different networks, talk to different people, be a part of different groups and circles. And so, really measuring again, what does your board look like? How much resources and money are you putting towards these initiatives? How fruitful are these initiatives? Are they performative, right? So it's really doing a full breakdown. And then also to asking yourself questions when you're maybe providing new services to the community, or when you're putting out new initiatives, are there different questions that you can put in place? So from an equity perspective, right, are there four questions we can ask ourselves to say, is this an equitable process? Is this an equitable program, right? Putting those things in place and then measuring that. But it has to be intentional, and it has to be, culturally sensitive. It has to be all these different things. And a lot of times people don't know what they don't know. And so that's why as consultants, we come in and we kind of help mm-hmm. that.
You touched on this earlier, but the landscape of DEI seems to be changing. Mm-hmm. Three states have enacted anti-DEI bills and, mm-hmm. and 10 more have passed bills in at least one legislative chamber. Mm-hmm. How does that sit with you?
So it's uneasy, right? Because we can say from a New York State perspective, right? Some people may say, oh, we're good, right? That's happening down south.
Right.
But it has a trickle down effect, right? And so when I think about all those different things, it is a very uneasy feeling. It's a very unsettling feeling because also, too, I think about our future. I think about the kids. I think about those who are younger than us and what will they be experiencing as they're growing up. A lot of the legislation and laws that we're seeing are laws that are going to set precedent for years mm-hmm. down the line, right? Even if you're looking at from a Supreme Court level, our Supreme Court, no matter where you sit on the spectrum of Democrat, Republican, whatever, conservatism, we have a conservative Supreme Court who are setting laws and legislation that is turning back the clock, right? Keep going back to abortion and women's rights. Mm-hmm. It is turning back the clock, and we are seeing it unfold in front of our faces. And it has a trickle-down effect. And so even if you live in New York State, your family can be affected, right? You choose to move. I know I have conversations with friends all the time to say, can I move to Texas? Can I move to Georgia? Right. As a woman, as a Black woman.
Right.
Right. These are very real things. You're traveling. I mean, even, my friends and I talk about this all the time. We went to Aku and I, who is my co-host for Black Gems Dive In, we were able to go to Memphis, Tennessee, to the Civil Rights Museum last year. And it was a really transformational process in the sense of, again, you understand and you look at your culture and you look at your heritage and your ancestors and what they had to go through. But actually walking through that museum and getting to the point where, okay, you know, we're in the civil rights era and we're looking at the Green Book. So for those who don't know who what the Green Book is it was literally a book mm-hmm. that was supplied to Black families as they were traveling up and down from north to south, south to north, and where they can stop to feel safe, whether it's hotels, restaurants, gas stations.
Yeah, everywhere.
Everywhere, because we know there was so much hate and just... just everything that was going on at that
avoiding
time.
Avoiding sundown towns.
Sundown
and stuff like
towns,
that.
Yes, yes. So we were able to pick up the last Green Book that was published in the 60s, and we're looking through it, and we're looking at places even in Buffalo, New York, mm-hmm. right, where people were able to stop. You see the Michigan Corridor, you see Jefferson, you see all these different things, right? And so you have the Green Book. And we talk about this all the time. Do we need a modern day Green Book? Do we need that as Black people traveling in our country? Because you do see some of these things reversing, right, and going back. And so even though these laws may affect other states and other areas, it is still affecting you too as well. And so we have to continue to fight. You know, where I sit with the National Urban League Young Professionals, I travel a lot. I talk to different people. I'll go to Washington and I'll be marching in the streets, right? But I'm also in the White House talking to some officials as well to say, what can we do? How can we continue to push the message forth? Because also, too, even though there's legislation is affecting other places, the rhetoric, right, still permeates throughout the country.
Yes.
And so that's really important because it allows people to have dangerous rhetoric. It allows people to have passes, right? And so laws affect attitudes. And so even though you may feel like it's not affecting you, it is affecting you no matter where you are in this country.
So what's it going to take to counteract what's currently happening? Is it simple as a state like New York State taking a stronger stand and strengthening their DEI legislation? Is it, I don't know, expanding the Supreme Court as many have discussed?
Yeah. So there's several things that we can do. And I recognize that people sit, not physically sit, but they sit in different places, right? You have people who are in legislation. You have people who are in not-for-profits. You have people in corporations. Mm-hmm. Everyone has their own job and duty to double down on DEI efforts because ultimately it affects everyone. We know this, right? There's endless studies about how DEI can really transform an organization, how if you are not providing different services to folks from an educational perspective, from a healthcare perspective, we're talking about social determinants of health, there's literally a wealth gap that will mm-hmm. affect you too, because who's going to buy your products? Who's going to, you know, how are we going to exist as a society if people have these gaps? So we have a duty, not just specifically in New York State, but everywhere, to double down on this DEI efforts because, first of all, it's just healthier for everyone from an organizational standpoint, from a health perspective, all these different things. But then also, too, and I know so many people are disenfranchised by the voting system.
Yes.
However, we have to continue to vote, and we have to continue to vote even on the local level. Every role is important,
right?
From the school board election, right? School board elections are nonpartisan, meaning that they do not run along party lines of Democrat, Republican, or whatever. However, it is equally as important because who are educating your kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
What systems are they putting in place, right? We talk about all the time how in schools growing up, we didn't learn about Black history. We didn't learn about all these different things, but your school board can really set the tone for those type of things. And so are you voting in the school board election here in Buffalo? I know the past couple of elections have been really low, like really, really low. Somewhere around 3-4% of people voting in those elections. We have to get out to school board elections. We have to get out to county legislative elections, voting for the mayor, voting for whoever we can at the local level, because ultimately they do affect national legislation.
Right. All politics are
all
local.
All politics are local. And it takes time, right? A couple of people have had conversations with to say, you know, the world has not changed in the past 4 to 8 years. The world hasn't changed since Obama became elected, right? You hear that all the time, right? But you have to think about, again, everything takes time. We think about even when my grandparents were growing up, even when my parents were growing up, my dad is from Birmingham, Alabama, and I hear the stories all the time, and things have changed. However, we have to continue to push for it, and we have to start at our local elections. It is going to take time, right? You you can get easily disenfranchised when you're listening to media, when you're hearing some of the rhetoric that's being pushed. But we have a duty to continue to push forward. And that's, you know, some of my life work that I do.
Well said. This is What's Next. And I want to thank our guests, Kendra Brim and Dr. Henry Louis Taylor Jr. You're listening to WBFO News. This is WBFO and WBFO HD1 Buffalo, WOLN Olean, and WUBJ Jamestown, your NPR station.